And really what I want to do is help people understand this power, this ability we have in our mind, our psychology, our mindset, to pretty much dictate and not control, not guarantee, but give us the best possible chance of achieving whatever we want in our life. All comes from how we think about things.
Welcome to The Power Hour, the weekly podcast that will motivate you to pursue your passion and to achieve success. I'm Adrienne Herbert, international speaker, fitness coach, Adidas global ambassador, and entrepreneur. Each week, I'll be talking to today's leading coaches, creatives, change makers, and innovators to find out their daily habits, morning routines, and rules to live by. The Power Hour is all about taking just 1 hour each day to help you improve your life and unlock your full potential. Whether you want to build a business, write a book, run a marathon, or maybe you're just looking for a spark of inspiration, the Power Hour is going to help you get there faster. Welcome back to the Power Hour podcast. So this is the first time that I've ever recorded the podcast remotely without having the guest sitting in front of me in the studio. But as we are, you know, kind of making our way through this next few weeks or months, we're going to keep the podcast going. I really, really want to keep as many interviews and episodes coming to you guys as possible. I think it's really, really important that we stay connected, but also, you know, listen and learn and listen to something uplifting and motivating, which is what I hope to bring to you each week on the show. So here goes. Today's guest is an author, keynote speaker, and former professional footballer. Today, we're going to talk about his journey and what he learned from playing as a Premier League footballer for 16 years and then taking the leap of faith to study, change careers, and publish his first book. Welcome to the show, Paul McVie.
Adrian, thank you very much for having us.
As I said, first time recording remotely. It's so strange to not be able to see your face and be able to connect with you. But I'm really grateful that you've given us the time today to get on this recording.
Listen, that's not necessarily a bad thing that you don't have to look at this face. I actually used to get a lot of stick over the years in the changing room about having a baby face and looking so young. But being 42 now, then that face isn't as young as what it used to be.
Oh, no. Well, I'm sure it's served you well, Paul, because now, you know, you're on TV. So who's laughing now?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. So as I mentioned at the start, you know, you played professional football for 16 years in the Premier League and, you know, you played for Tottenham, you played for Norwich. And, you know, that industry is, you know, it's ruthless, isn't it? So I think, you know, being a part of that for so long, I mean, there must be so many things that you learned. Where do you start?
Where do you start? Well, the first thing I should say is that I've never been introduced. And the first thing that someone said to me is an author, first of all. So it's amazing how just the way that you've picked up on this and thought, right, okay, I'm going to go for author, then keynote speaker, then footballer. And mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll talk about it further down the line about identity and just how important that is of what we think about ourselves and also about what other people think of us. And it's so funny over, well, I was in professional football for 20 years playing and then even longer from whenever I started working as a sports psychologist in it as well. And it's so interesting that the first thing that people have always associated with me is as a footballer, whereas your introduction started off with the author. So I quite like that. That's a good little turning it around.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you said that about identity, because I think for so many people, we can be defined by what we do. You know, we don't necessarily have to be, but I think many people can be defined by what they do, what they choose to pursue as a career. And I guess, yeah, for someone as a professional footballer, I mean, the stereotypes around what that's like, but what's the reality of, you know, being a pro sportsman for 16 years and also being part of a team?
Well, I suppose the first thing I would say is that it was amazing. It was just absolutely, how can you describe? Okay, so let me put it this way. So growing up on the streets of Belfast, you know, I grew up in quite a troubled time of the 70s and 80s and 90s. And if you don't know anything about the troubles of Northern Ireland, then it would be safe to say that tanks driving down your street and soldiers walking past you with rifles pointing them in your face, you know, hitting you across the head, etc., etc. These things were just normal growing up in that era of the 70s and 80s in Belfast. But of course, because you're a kid, you just think that that's normal. You know, I just thought that walking to school, everybody saw tanks driving down the streets. But then I came across England and realized maybe that's not so normal. So, but as a kid, you just think it's normal. But the only other thing that I did when I was growing up was just playing football. So every single day before school, you went in and played football. In the break times, you're playing football. Lunchtime, you're playing football. After school, you're playing football. You come home, get changed. If your mum's not home, you quickly run straight out. Otherwise, you'd make you do your homework. And then you go out and do more football. So you're doing it all day long. And Imagine doing that every day with all your friends. That's all you did until you're 16. And then suddenly, one of the biggest clubs in the world in England, Tottenham Hotspur, come across and say, would you like to do this every single day with other amazing players and other professionals? And I thought, yep, that sounds like a great idea. So then I went across to London in 94 and started playing in at Tottenham Hotspur and had a couple of years in youth team. And then suddenly the manager went, here, we quite like you. Do you think we could give you a professional contract and pay you some more money? I thought, yeah, sounds really good. And then suddenly in the first year, at the end of the first year, the manager suddenly turns around and goes, by the way, we think you're good enough to get in our first team. Do you want to go out and play in front of thousands of people and play on match of the day every week? I thought, yeah, do you know what? That's really, really good. And imagine that's your life. And just people just keep going, here, let's give you more money. Let's put you in even more ridiculous situations that possibly every football fan as a kid grows up wanting to do. And you end up being the one that does it. It's wow. Really, really hard to describe just how incredibly amazing your life is in that environment. But that's obviously one side of the story, because that's your dreams and everything you ever wanted to do, and to be able to go and do that and achieve that. And I suppose not only the playing football, but actually one of the goals I had, because we'll probably come on to this a bit later, but I was quite weird because I was very kind of goal orientated. I was very focused as a kid that I just wanted to be a Premier League footballer and just wanted to be an international footballer. So that's all I wanted to do. And by 19, I'd kind of achieved that goal. But it wasn't just about playing one game in the Premier League. I actually wanted to play a lot of games. And it wasn't just about playing professional football for one season. I wanted to have a long-term career. So it went from there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you're being incredibly modest by, you know, this description of, you know, oh, you know, played and then they asked me to play here. Because, you know, football is incredibly competitive. There's hundreds and hundreds and thousands of, you know, young athletes, young footballers who want to make it. So you must have been incredibly talented, firstly, but also nothing comes without hard work. So I suppose having that goal-oriented mindset, you know, straight from the start, do you think that it informed your behavior and your choices? Because as you said, if you were playing football for hours and hours and hours a day, that's not necessarily the same as, you know, my son likes football and he enjoys watching it and he enjoys playing it. But, you know, he goes to practice on a Thursday night, he plays a match on a Saturday, he might kick a ball around, you know, for maybe a couple of hours in the week, but he's certainly not putting in, you know, 5-6 hours a day.
Yeah, well, that's the interesting side, because, you know, whenever you kind of are growing up and we talked about identity and people just said, oh, that's Paul, he's the footballer. And because you kind of just, for me anyway, it was just taken as normal. And because I was going across the Tottenham Hotspur from an 11-year-old, so it was always something that was associated with my life. So it was just something that I did. So interestingly, people would have said that I had natural ability, but, you know, I'm sure you've come across all of the research that talks about, you know, how probably this natural ability isn't really just natural ability. It probably has something to do with all the hours and hours it was spending playing football. It was probably the fact that you were playing in better teams and you were improving. You were playing against better players, which obviously needed to improve your skill if you wanted to try and compete. But I suppose, you know, fast forward in 20 years to, you know, having done my master's in sports psychology and understanding, you know, that this ability probably isn't the natural ability I've, and that's part of why I wrote the book, because the ability that I had, it was the ability I developed at a professional level, and people who get to any kind of mastery of whatever their craft is, then that is developing over hours and hours, days, weeks, months and years to improve in this until you suddenly can compete at an elite level. And it is interesting that you said about being a very ruthless and competitive industry. And, you know, whenever I'm doing my keynotes with different businesses, that's one of the points that I make, that, you know, getting to the top, and I'm not saying I got to the very top, because, you know, there were thousands of people way better than I was. So, but if I talk about someone like Cristiano Ronaldo, it's really interesting because Cristiano Ronaldo, when he was a young player at Manchester United, he was only 18 and he was, you know, they'd obviously bought him for about 12 million. So they clearly they knew he had potential and knew he was a good player, but he was nowhere near the best in the world. But over the last probably 10, 12 years, Cristiano Ronaldo has got to the very top of what I would consider the most competitive and the most ruthless industry on the planet. And the way I normally qualify that is to say that there were so many kids like me, like Cristiano Ronaldo, like players all over the world who were growing up wanting to be professional footballers. And the interesting thing is they don't just want to be professional footballers in their country. Where do the most players want to play? In England, because it's in the Premier League, because it's the most money, it's the most prestigious. And so getting to the top of the Premier League really, for me, shows someone who gets to the very top of the most ruthless and competitive industry on the planet.
And it's so interesting what you described then around your natural ability and, you know, the whole nature nurture conversation. As you said, it's like you have to have a talent, but I think once you, I guess you had that identity, you know, again, growing up that, oh, you're the footballer, Paul's the footballer. And then you start to think, well, you know, football's my thing and football's what I'm good at. And that gives you the confidence, I guess, when you're going into situations to, you know, perform and deliver in a different way. And yeah, I do think it's really interesting the, I guess even the psychology behind that, because, you know, if you're constantly told, because it works both ways, right? It can also work the other way around. If you're constantly told that you're not good at that, you're not good at that, or you're not the best at that, don't get your hopes up. Then even if you are talented, I think I see it going the other way. And people often, you know, they don't believe in themselves or their abilities and they don't pursue something or try it because they've always been told, oh, you're not that good at that. Do you? And actually, you know, with the right amount of skill acquisition, practice, repetition, who's to say that they couldn't become, you know, as good as anybody else?
Well, you're suddenly going very much into my area of passion and enthusiasm, because everything around psychology is just something that I've been fascinated with, Adrian, for the last must be 25 years now. I told you I was very focused on wanting to be a professional footballer, but actually it was whenever I was 17, because, you know, as much as I was a decent player when I was growing up, I was never the best player in the team. So this is just probably something we need to establish now, that the player that I was always, you know, right in the middle of the group. I was never the best player, but I was never the worst player. I was never the best athlete, but I was never the worst athlete. And technically I was never the best, but it wasn't. So I was almost like right slap bang in the middle of most of the teams that I played in. And this is where, for me, it's really interesting. Why is it that someone who's average athlete, average technically, average tactically, can go on and have a long-term career in professional football, where there was players who were the best player, who were the best athlete, and didn't? And for me, the only answer I can ever come up with of why that happened was down to my mindset or my psychology or the way that I thought about things. And, you know, you talk about whether someone tells you can do something and probably the belief that that child might get from it, or whether someone tells them they can't do it and maybe the lack of confidence that they will have. But actually for me, it was all about what can I do differently that's going to allow me to have a long-term career, and what can I do differently to give me an edge over pretty much everyone that I'm competing against in my team. And for me, that always came back to my mindset and psychology.
Yeah, I'm also fascinated with mindsets and psychology as well. And I think it's so interesting that the different athletes that I've interviewed on the show, you know, whether, especially if you're, I think being in a team, it must be slightly different, because a lot of the athletes that I've interviewed who, if they're, you know, in athletics and it's a solo thing, you know, a lot of their training is on their own, they're competing on their own. And although they feel as though they're part of a team, for example Team GB, it's just very solo. Whereas for you, you know, you mentioned then about being competitive, and do you think it was different kind of having this pursuit of success as a team, or did you still feel like you were competing with the people in your own team?
Well, I suppose this is interesting. Whenever I get asked to do a lot of keynotes about team performance and, you know, performing better as a team, and I think what I always come back to is the fact that the team is made up of individuals. And as much as I've always been in teams, and even like even all the exercise that I do now and pretty much everything I do now, I always do it in groups. So I hate going out for a run by myself, but love going running in a group. and I hate going to do weights by myself, but I love going doing running and or weights in a three or four people. So I'm such a pack animal, and I have been, obviously, because I've been in probably a team environment for so long. But it's always the individual that needs to be performing. So even though the team is the most important thing, and it's more important than all the individuals, as soon as one individual doesn't perform within that team dynamics, then the team doesn't perform. So that's why, as much as any team is always greater than the sum of the parts, it's always down to, I believe, the individual's mindset or psychology that's going to dictate whether that team performs. Because if that one person isn't performing to their level, then the team isn't going to function, or it's not going to function as efficiently or productively as what it could do. So actually, the team is really, it's really fascinating for me, because I still haven't got anyone, or I've never had a conversation with anyone that has can convince me to say that there's anything more important in the team than an individual psychology.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I guess there's so many things, there's so many different things that contribute, I think, to a team dynamic. So I mentioned in the intro, Paul, that you took a leap of faith. So you retired at the age of 32 and you decided to retrain and to study sports psychology. So how did you have the confidence at that time to make that decision? Because for a lot of people, I think they have ideas about changing careers, or about, you know, what if this, what if that, maybe one day, but they don't often have the confidence to actually take that leap of faith.
Well, I suppose there was two parts of it. The first thing was that I was getting really old and slow, and I couldn't keep up with the with the younger players. So one was a bit of a leap of faith, another one was a bit of a push over the edge, because you can't keep up. But I think it goes back to what I mentioned about 10 minutes ago around identity. So a lot of sportsmen, women, athletes in general, even people who are in the military, we kind of touched on earlier about how, you know, the identity of the job that you do can sometimes define people. Whereas, you know, if you speak to someone who's either a doctor or a lawyer, you know, that's it. They're just a doctor or a lawyer, and their whole job almost can consume them. And I probably, because I was so interested in personal development and mindset and psychology, that I came across this topic of identity and your beliefs and how powerful they can be. And it made me think that if I solely had a belief that I was only a professional footballer, and without going kind of too deep into it, that's actually an extrinsic event. And what I mean by that is I can't go up to Manchester United and say, give me a professional contract. I can go to Tottenham Hotspur, even if I'm at Tottenham Hotspur, and say, give me another professional contract. So it's an extrinsic event, because someone has to give me the contract for me to sign it. I can put myself in the best possible position. I can be as fit as I can be. I can train hard. I can do everything I can do to get myself in that position, but it's still external to me. It's extrinsic, so I don't have that control. And it made me think that actually, if I can only see myself as a professional footballer, and because I don't have the power to dictate whether I'm a professional footballer or not, and someone takes that away from me, it felt very, very vulnerable. And what it made me think was, actually, instead of just being a professional footballer, how else do I identify? And then I started to think, well, actually, I'm also, you know, a son to my parents, I'm a brother to my brothers and sisters, I'm a friend, I'm obviously, you know, I had a girlfriend at the time, I started renting houses to students, so I thought I was a landlord. I was doing my sports science degree, so I thought myself as a student. I started learning Italian, so I thought of myself as a linguist. Then I started learning music, piano and guitar, so I thought I was a, you know, musician, even though a pretty bad one at the time. Anyway, all these things, it was just different ways of me being able to identify as all these things in my life, instead of just thinking I'm just a footballer. And also as well, at the time, especially in the 90s and early 2000s, the reputation of footballers was pretty bad. You know, it wasn't, you know, there was a lot of people had very, very low opinions of professional footballers. And, you know, again, fast forward in 10 years to whenever actually I wrote my book, and the book, the title of it was The Stupid Footballer is Dead. And the reason why I got that published with Bloomsbury is because I wanted to try and completely blow this myth that footballers were stupid, because I knew loads of footballers who were, you know, they don't have to necessarily be academically super smart, but they were really switched on. And, you know, I've yet to come across anybody who can walk into football and change room and get the best of a group of footballers, because they're so clever and so astute of working people out, because especially in that public environment, we get, and footballers get, thousands and thousands of people approach them every year. So you're really good at working out what people want and what they want from you. So just the fact that I thought this reputation the footballers had wasn't, you know, it was very unfair. And I thought that actually, I know people who actually, one was studying to do his law firm, studying to be a lawyer, you know, and one was trying to be an accountant. I knew loads of people who actually were academically smart. And I just hated this fact that most people thought that I was stupid. I thought, well, actually, this identity of being a footballer isn't really that good. So actually, that was another reason why I wrote the book, because you really needed to blow this myth out of the water that the footballers were stupid. And hopefully the book goes a little bit about that. But actually, then going back to the leap of faith question, it is to do with, I really thought that I needed something else to add to my credibility as a keynote speaker and a sports psychologist at the time, to hopefully allow other people to see that, you know, I'm not just living off the back of my playing career, that there's actually something I can offer, whether it's in the keynote speaking world, in the business world, in the sports psychology world. And that's when I went off and did my master's in sports psychology.
I can definitely relate to what you're saying then about the vulnerability piece, you know, around kind of not having control of your own kind of career destiny, life destiny. You know, I used to be a dancer. I used to be in a musical in the West End, and I've got lots of friends who are professional dancers, professional actors, actresses, my brother as well. And that, you know, that thing you described of, you can do all the things to put yourself in the best position, you know, you can be amazingly talented and disciplined and work hard, but essentially you're still gonna, in that industry anyway, go into an audition. You might be auditioning with 40 other people, it might be 200 other people, but it's ultimately down to someone else to make that decision whether you get the job or not. It's not actually even about talent, you know, it's just about whatever it is, the jigsaw that fits together to cast that show. And I know for a lot of actors, actresses, dancers, I'm sure it's the same for many industries, where you can perhaps do that for so long, and you know, you can have highs and lows and obviously, you know, some success, but you ultimately, it doesn't matter how successful you are, even if you're the leading lady in a West End show for 5 years, you still have to kind of go back into that audition round feeling again of, is someone going to give me a job? And, you know, for many unemployed actors, actresses, dancers, it's that constant limbo of, and also the highs of, like, when you are performing and when you are in this amazing contract, you're kind of being told that, you know, you're the star, you know, literally you are the star. And then the contrast to that of being like, actually, yeah, you're waiting for someone else to give you permission or to give you that job. And I think that maybe as well as we get older, perhaps we change our view on that, because, you know, when you're maybe, I don't know, early 20s, you're kind of happy to just roll with it. You know what I mean? But then later on in life, you think, actually, I want to have some control and like some say in, yeah, my career and in my future and in my life.
Absolutely. And I was going to say, it actually takes a special type of person to do that kind of role or work in those industries. But I don't think it's a special type of person. I think it's a special type of mindset, because it's a bit like a sales person. They have to be able to take so many no's just to get that yes. And the ability to take no after no after no after no and then get the yes is the same as going to be for a dance audition, or if you're a singer, or, you know, I ran down plenty of trials as a professional footballer. And, you know, this is the funny thing. This is where, you know, football for me is so amazing in so many ways, because it gives you everything you could possibly ever want, but then also just slaps you in the face and hits you down as well, and just put you on your backside. Because, you know, I'd played in the Premier League, I'd been player of the year, top scorer, Nari, done all these different things, inducted into the Hall of Fame, and then they released me, and then I went on trial with 4 different clubs. And you're thinking, this is very strange. Why am I going on trial when for the last, you know, 7 years I've been playing in all these different leagues and different stadia all around England, all around Europe? And you just think, well, that's just the way football is. You know, it has this amazing way of just bringing everybody back to a kind of a level pegging. But I suppose that's also good, because then it stops all these egos from getting out of control and giving people a little bit of humility, which is always a good thing.
Yeah, for sure. So for anyone listening who's thinking that, you know, maybe they want to change careers or they want to study something new. And you know what, we've got a lot in common, Paul, because I'm also learning Italian. So when I heard you say I kind of laughed to myself because I say that I'm learning Italian, but I've not been as disciplined as I'd like to be. So it's slow, but I'm trying. For anyone who wants to start, you know,
do you want to speak in Italian at the minute or do you want to get
definitely not, definitely not. That stage, definitely not that stage. I won't embarrass myself, but hey, you know, I'm trying, so I feel like I'm using the Duolingo app, and I also went to some Italian lessons in a school, which it's kind of felt weird because it was just in a local high school after school hours, so I felt like I was going literally back to school, so that was kind of strange. But yeah, I'm definitely not ready for the chat yet. But I wanted to say, you know, when you went back to studying your master's, I read that you didn't enjoy the studying process at all. So how did you?
Hell no.
How did you, I guess, stay disciplined to complete it? Because for so many people, the thought of going back and, yeah, as I said, back to school, restudying it, they just think, no way, I couldn't do it. Forget it.
Two things I would say. One, I'm a stubborn little git. So that's the first thing that I was just like, it's not going to beat me. And the second thing was that I'd set a goal for myself. Mm-hmm. So this is probably a different side of what I do in my life, that since I was 17, I don't know if it did mention earlier, I think I touched on it, but when I was 17, I read a book by a guy called Tony Robbins, who I'm pretty sure a lot of people would know. Mm-hmm. And it was a book called Awaken the Giant Within. Now, whenever I got this book, you know, I can even just visualizing it now, I can remember one of my friends' brother-in-law's gave it to me because he was very close friend at the time, still is. And I remember he gave me this book. I opened the book and he had this little inscription and it said, "To your success, November 95, best wishes, Tim." So I remember getting this book all those years ago, reading this book. And when I talked about coming across from Belfast and the mindset that I had, as someone from Belfast, whatever that was at the time, when I read this book, it was like the blinkers were just completely thrown off the way I viewed the world. And I remember just thinking, wow. And because it's such a chunky book, it's like probably 500 or 600 pages in the book, but you know, this might show you as well how I was a bit weird as a 17-year-old kid, as a young professional footballer, reading 600 page books on personal development. But effectively, the whole message in the book, you could sum it up in one line saying, stop looking outside of yourself, because everything you will ever need in your life, you've already got.
Wow, and that is really powerful. So that was called Awaken the Giant Within.
Awaken the Giant Within. And I remember, now this is obviously me summing up this book, but that was effectively what the most powerful message in the book was. And I just remember finishing and putting it down. Well, every time you read a chapter, it was just another, my mind was getting blown with every single page that I turned. But effectively, the book changed my life, because whatever trajectory I was going on at that time, and suddenly as a 17-year-old, I started looking at the world around me with just a completely different filter. So I'll give an example. Because I was a kid, I wanted to be a professional footballer. Then I read this book, and I didn't just want to be a professional footballer. I wanted to have a long-term career in professional football. And one of the incidents that happened, we'd go into the physio room every day, which is pretty much where all the players congregate, just to have a bit of crack and just to, you know, slag each other and get your strappings and whatever you needed to get ready before training. So that was like the hub of the training ground. So I was in there in 1995. I was reading this book, and I saw our captain at the time, was a guy called Gary Mabbott. So anyone who might know Gary Mabbott, he played nearly 700 games for Spurs. So he was just an amazing guy. And whenever I found out later on when he'd retired that he actually had diabetes and he still played 700 games for Spurs, it was just phenomenal. Anyway, so he's the club captain. But I saw this guy who was probably a 35 or 36-year-old guy on the physio bed. And for about 40 to 45 minutes every single morning, he was either getting strapped up, he was getting rubbed, he was getting massaged, he was getting clicked, he was getting cracked, he was getting tablets, he was getting sometimes injections, just to get him out onto the training pitch to go and train every day. Wow. And I remember thinking, as a 16, 17-year-old kid, looking at him going, he's the club captain, he's like the most experienced player in the whole club, but he's still only a 35 or 36-year-old guy. And no matter what you do in football and what you do in life, you're probably going to be living hopefully to 70, 80, 90 if you're lucky. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, I never want to end up like him. Like, even if it allowed me to play 700 games for Spurs, I never want to end up like him. Because I thought the one thing that I really want of professional football is to leave professional football injury-free. So then I started looking around, and as these little things happen, and we have this thing in our brain called our reticular activating system, which is a bit like a kind of an antenna or filter of things that we kind of notice that are important to us. And because I had this, I want to finish football injury free. I was having a conversation with mum every Sunday night, which we did. So speaking to my mum, and she suddenly came across this conversation. She said, "Paul, have you ever tried yoga?" And I was like, "Yoga? No." And she went, "I think you should try it. I think it'd be really good for you." And I was, and, you know, without sounding rude, but I was like, what, in a church hall with a bunch of middle-aged women? It's not really for me, you know, not as a 16, 17-year-old kid. And she was like, "But it's really, really good for your flexibility. Would that help your football?" And I thought, yeah, that would be good. And she goes, "And it's really good to improve your strength. Would that help your football?" She's like, "Yeah." And she goes, "And it reduces injuries. Would that help your football?" It's like, yeah. She goes, "And it improves your core strength." And I was like, "What's core strength?" You know, you didn't even know about that at the time. So all of these things until eventually I was like, right, okay, I'll do that. And so this turned out that I then started, because I didn't have the cojones to go and do yoga in the training ground at the time. So I bought a video. Do you remember, Adrian, are you old enough to remember what a video is?
I am indeed. It's just
okay,
about.
Okay,
just
okay.
About.
Okay. Okay. So anybody before Netflix and streaming, you know, we had these things called videos, and so I used to watch this video every single day before training. So I was going into training already completely stretched out, feeling fit, feeling, you know, ready to go. So this happened for a number of years while I did this at home, because I basically didn't have the ability to go in and do it at the training ground. And eventually when I got to Norwich City, so it was like probably 4 or 5 years later, after being doing it at home, until I thought, hold on a minute, I'm a first team player, scoring goals in the championship, you know, I'm playing every week, I can go and do what I want here. So I walked in with my yoga mat on the first day. Anyway, I went in and tried to do yoga, and not joking, they took it off me. They cut it up into little pieces. They completely, ripped it up, right? And you know what I talked about when I'm doing my masters? I said I'm a stubborn little git. So I'm like, right, they're not beating me. So I came back in the next day, went and bought another yoga mat. And I went out, trained, come back in, and they burnt it this time.
Oh, my
literally
God.
Physically
what, the other
set
players?
It
the other players?
Yeah. Set it on fire, because, like, why are you doing yoga? So again, went and bought another yoga mat. And this time, whenever I'd gone out and I'd come back in from training, and they'd had it out in the car park, and they were doing, you know, like donuts in the car over the top of it.
Oh,
so they completely ruined it. Until eventually, I'm like, there's no way these bunch of retrobates are going to beat me. So I bought another yoga mat. Eventually went into the side of the physio room, put the yoga mat out, started doing the yoga mat. I'm not joking. I was getting pelters from everybody coming in, slagging me, shouting at me, you know, giving me all sorts of abuse. But carried on. And this is the interesting thing, because this is almost like the three pillars of change that have, like, sort of how anything changes really in society or across life. That the first thing is normally this kind of violent opposition of we can't do it like this. That's impossible. You shouldn't be doing this. Why are you doing this kind of thing? Then the second part of that, of the second pillar of change, is a bit of a curiosity. So what started happening when I was going in every single day, instead of people coming in and slagging me, because obviously people were getting bored of saying the same things and I was carrying on doing it, eventually someone stuck his head in and went, "Paul, what are you doing that for?" And I was like, "Well, I'll just do it just because it helps me feel better. So whenever I go out to do the warm-up, I'm already stretched and feel good before we start training." And he's like, "All right, okay." Until eventually the third pillar of change is acceptance. So you have this violent opposition, then you have this curiosity of this newfound, what are you doing? And then finally there's acceptance. So what suddenly happened after a couple of weeks of me doing this every single day in the physio room, players started coming in and joining me while I was doing yoga.
I love that. I've heard that before, that, you know, this idea that the first they'll ask you why, then they'll ask you how. And I think it's really interesting that, well, firstly, I'm picturing you, you know, as you describe this, like, pro footballer, you know, that kind of stereotypical, the bad rep that they had. And then there's you, like, opening up your backpack to get your Tony Robbins book out and your yoga mat. I'm like, who is this guy? You were ahead of your time. You were ahead of your time, Paul, because now I feel like the world of sports, of sports science, of psychology, of wellness, nutrition, mindfulness. I feel like they're all, you know, linked. And now people know that, okay, I need to sleep well. I need to have mobility. I need to eat well. I feel like it's accepted, as you said, acceptance. It's accepted that all of these things are what make up, you know, the athlete and the body. And so you were just way ahead of your time.
Well, it's really interesting because it all goes back to, so you know how we're kind of all very self-serving, that, you know, we'll just do things that will probably benefit us in our life. A lot of the time, obviously, we'll do things that probably don't help our lives sometimes, but a lot of the times we're doing things that help us. So really, it was that all these, I don't even know if it's stars aligning, it's just probably taking all these different snippets of information, and I'm reading a book over here, I'm going in and seeing our club captain, I'm speaking to my mum on the phone. I had to then have another conversation with my dad on the phone. And this is just all just random conversations. I don't think they were planning this. And he said, you know, Paul, have you ever heard of visualization? And again, I'd never heard of it at the time. No, I was 17 at the time. And he said, well, because my dad's a big golf fan, Jack Nicklaus, who was the greatest golfer ever, one of the most majors, more than Tiger Woods. And he said, listen, before Jack Nicklaus plays every shot on the golf course, he visualizes where he wants the ball to go. So why don't you try this technique for football? Because obviously it's a skill. It might be something that might help your game. So suppose what I haven't told you at this point, and I didn't realize it, but looking back and you start to analyze some of these things, that I was clearly very open-minded. And all it was that I said I was focused. I was also goal-orientated. And because I wanted to be a professional footballer, I pretty much would have done anything that I thought would help me to become a professional footballer. And of course, because I know I'm not the best player and I'm not the best athlete, I'm looking for an advantage that's going to help me more than anyone else. So I started doing this thing called visualization. And my dad sent across, you know, made the joke about the video, but this is going really old school. He sent me across a cassette. Mm-hmm. That's stretching it. So we know what a cassette is. So anyone who's younger might not know, but they can Google it. Anyway, so he sent me across a cassette and I started listening to a Paul McKenna cassette on visualization, and I was doing that every single day, week after week, month after month, for pretty much about 5 years. Now this is interesting, Adrian, because whenever I'm doing my speaking gigs and I'm going all around the world doing it, and I know you're doing the same thing, and my first almost opening gambit is putting on a little video, 2 minute video of just me scoring a few goals whenever I was playing over the years. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I do it is, one, because I've got this really bad blonde highlights at the time, but, you know, it was fashionable, so, but it gives everybody a laugh, shows me scoring a few goals. But then the other thing is that I ask people, can anyone recognize the most common type of goal that I scored during this little 2 minute video clip? And it turns out the most common type of goal I scored was me getting the ball on the left-hand side of a football pitch, cutting in around the edge of the 18-yard box and trying to curl it over the top into the top right-hand corner over the goalkeeper. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much the most common type of goal I scored in my career. Probably 50% of my goals were like that. And when I then tell people that as a 17-year-old kid, having that conversation with my dad on visualization, I visualized just one single scenario every single day for about 5 years. And my one scenario was getting the ball on the left-hand side of the pitch, cutting in to the edge of the 18-yard box and curling it over the very top of the goalkeeper into the top right-hand corner. And this is where it gets interesting, because all of my keynote speaking is all about how mental performance for me is probably the reason why I've done anything that I've done in my life. And actually, it's the reason why all of us are doing anything. It's the reason why you get up every morning at 5:30, the reason why you go running, the reason why you're doing your marathons, the reason why you're doing this podcast and all the dancing and everything else you've done. It's all to do with our mental performance. Now, some people call it psychology, some people call it mindset, some people call it our thinking. I just believe that because my life has always been about performance, I've been judged on my performance every single day for about 25 years. And I'm happy with that, because that's just part of the world I've lived in. And now, whenever I'm doing my speaking gigs, I get instant feedback on that, on how well I'm speaking or not. And I get that judgment, which is fine. But I believe that our mental performance is so important. That's why I call it mental performance, because we're all performing at a certain level mentally. And interestingly, that one visualization scenario is something that I was doing every single day for 5 years. And 20 years later, I show a video and the majority of my goals were the one single scenario that I visualized when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And the other part of this is, because I've now gone and down the academic route of getting to a master's level of sports psychology, I now understand, well, actually, because I did that visualization, is that why I scored those goals? Well, cause and effect is such an incredibly complex thing. But once you understand that it probably wasn't 100% sole reason why I scored those goals, but I think it definitely had an impact. And really what I want to do is help people understand this power, this ability we have in our mind, our psychology, our mindset, to pretty much dictate and not control, not guarantee, but give us the best possible chance of achieving whatever we want in our life, all comes from how we think about things.
I absolutely agree.
And do you know what the sad thing about this is? Whenever I go through the different exercises and try and share these different, tenets of psychology, or, you know, different topics or subjects or strains or strands of how we think about things. And whenever I throw it back to the audience, because I'm always wanting to get them engaged and asking them, you know, how they do things. And when I throw it out and say, so, you know, so how much of your day, week, month, or year are you consciously dedicating time to improve your mental performance? What do you think the normal answer is I get?
Honestly, I don't think people spend any time, not every single day.
Yeah, it's generally zero. Yeah. Or you might have one person at the back of the room might put their hand up and say, oh, I did some goal setting a couple of years ago and I might have them in a drawer somewhere. And for me, it's like I'm not standing there judging people, you know. It was interesting that I was listening to your podcast with Trevor Nelson, and he kept saying that a whole lot of times. You know, you're not judging people. All you're really doing is just sharing the fact that this has been probably the most important aspect of my life, and the reason why I was never the best player, but I had a long term professional football career. I was not the most high profile professional football. But then I've gone on and had a keynote speaking career that's taken me around the world. I was not the smartest kid in school, but I'm the only person on the planet that's got a master's in sports psychology and played in the Premier League. All these different things that I've done, it's not because I'm superhuman or good in any way. It's just because I have a way of thinking things that allows me to achieve what I really think is going to help me in my life.
Paul, I absolutely agree with you. Nodding my head, I'm like, all of the things around your own self-belief, the mindset, you know, the things you talked about with visualization and how powerful that is. I've seen it in my own life. I've definitely seen it in other people's lives. And also, I think even the opposite as well, you know, having, you know, anxiety or catastrophizing thoughts and negative patterns and kind of repeating that, it works both ways. You know, I think when you almost obsess as well for some people around, you know, the barriers and the negative things and the what ifs and the oh but this, oh but that, you know, that I don't think people realize sometimes how powerful that is and how much it can hold them back. And so often when, you know, hearing you speak then, it was so clear for you, you know, at the time you might not have been aware of it, but it was so clear for you what your goal was. As you said, you would have done anything to get it. You know, you were open-minded to those new ideas of, you know, visualization or yoga or these things that I think in certain industries, you know, within the wellness industry anyway, I feel like people are like very open to the idea of, you know, visualization, of yoga, you know, even yoga itself, you know, it teaches more. It's not just about the physical practice. So I think maybe in the wellness space, it's slightly different, but I definitely think in different industries, people, they either have like a closed mindset to it. So they kind of go, oh yeah, yeah, visualization, affirmation, blah, blah, think positive and all that rubbish. Or they kind of, I don't know, maybe they just never have considered that it's actually something that's valuable. It's actually something that is practical. It's not just a kind of woo-woo, nice to have, you know, listen to someone speak for an hour and that's it. It's actually, you know, really powerful and impactful. If you apply these things to your life, it can change the trajectory of your entire life. Like really, truly, I believe that. So, I mean, yeah, as I said, couldn't have said it better myself. I totally, totally agree with you. And Paul, I want to ask you about the Power Hour. So,
yeah,
on this show,
just don't make me say it.
Okay. Yeah, with your accent. I love that.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
For me, my power hour is all about the first hour of the day. Anyone who's listened to this show a few times will know that.
Yeah.
Or yeah, if they've seen me on Instagram, I'm always out at first thing in the morning. And for me, it's about movement around, yeah, setting my mind in the right way and starting the day in the way that I want to. So, Paul, I'd love to know, I'm sure you have a cultivated morning routine. I'd love to know what that routine is and also what time you get up in the morning.
Okay, so it definitely varies. I think I would say I am a creature of habit. I think we all probably are creatures of habit. And having a life that was very structured from footballing days for nearly 20 years, and then suddenly coming out of that, and now my life is so unstructured in a way that I'm traveling all the time for my work. So because for the last number of years, I was doing keynote speaking around the UK, and since I did my master's, I have started going further and further afield to America, Asia, Europe, different places. That now, because I'm traveling so much, my routine is very, very mixed and varied. But if I'm at home, if I wake up in my own bed, I generally don't have a set time to get up. So I think, you know, fair play to you that you get up at 5:30 every morning and you go straight for your run. So I think that's really, really impressive. And when I get up, probably the first thing that I want to do is to go and get showered so that I can come in and start my yoga. But I only do like probably 10 minutes in the morning of just going and doing some yoga. So because for me, and this is probably flipping back to that story I told you earlier, because I wanted to come out of football injury free, and luckily for me, 10 years ago, I left professional football and I haven't got any injuries. I don't have any, you know, serious niggles or anything at all. So for doing the yoga every single day is something that I think is hugely impactful for that, beneficial for me, and it just gets me into a really, really good place straight away. So I would be doing that, and then I would be going downstairs, and I started seeing one personal trainer. I've only seen one personal trainer in my life, and I did it about a year and a half ago, a guy called Luke Matthews in Norwich, and he's a fantastic guy. And he gave me a little, almost like a morning drink routine, and it was just like having one of those little, you know, the fizzy effervescent vitamin C tablets that you can drop into your water, plus some lemon, squeeze some lemon in, and some, he put in, said Himalayan salt as well, and put that in a liter. And that for me is pretty much it. I don't really have too many other things that I would do that it's, you know, rigorous or something, but I would probably try and do as many of those as I can. And in the last probably, I'd say maybe 3 to 6 months, I've just started doing more and more. Don't do it every day, so I'm not going to say I'm absolutely 100% on this, but more and more I'm having cold showers in the morning because I've come across that Wim Hof.
Wim Hof is in the house.
He is an amazing guy, and probably I haven't explored that as much as what I'd like to, but I always test myself. You know, sometimes, you know, I'll stand in front of the shower and I'll look at the shower and I'll think, feel like a warm shower today. It feels like your resilience is a bit down. Don't need the cold shower attack.
Yeah.
So, but then other times I'm like, right, come on, bring it on.
Yeah.
And it's honestly, just because you feel better to go and have a crack at it.
Yeah, well, honestly, we can talk about this offline, but the cold shower thing and the Wim Hof and the ice therapy, and honestly, we could talk about that for a whole hour because I've got a lot to say on that. And I do I do the fire and ice myself. My husband is the biggest fan of the cold shower. I don't think he's had a hot shower. I don't think he's had a hot shower in over a year. He does the cold shower every single day, regardless of the season. Big fan of that. Okay, that's interesting. I mean, obviously you mentioned that you travel around the globe, which unfortunately is not going to be the case for a while.
Nope.
So perhaps, you know, your yoga in the mornings, your effervescent vitamin C, and maybe even your cold shower will perhaps become your new normal, because we're all having to create a new power hour,
absolutely.
Right?
Well, the interesting thing is that two things I just want to say on this, and I'm not sure if I've gotten over this fact yet or if I'm still a little bit kind of hanging on, because you know it's all about being in the present moment.
Yeah.
But I was going to go and do a tour of Asia at the end of March, and that was going to go to China. I was going to have my first speaking gigs in China. I was going to Japan for the first time. I was going back to Hong Kong to speak there again. I've already been there. I was then going back to Singapore, and I've been there, but I was going to go. And I got confirmed about a week and a half ago that I was going to go and speak for Microsoft in Singapore.
Oh, wow. And now you're like, what's going on?
And then they closed the borders, and then the gig is cancelled. And I'm like, no.
Honestly, Paul, there's so many of us all in that situation right now.
I know. But listen, it's only just to say that is something that I really feel like it's all a case of, it's not happened now, but it will happen again in the future. But going back to the routine, see these next couple of months, straight away, I'm thinking, right, okay, what routine can I get myself into so that I know that when I get up, and it's almost like a bit like you talked about going back to school earlier. I'm like, right, okay, I need to get up at this time. I want to go and do my yoga before I leave the house. And then this morning, went for a run at 9 o'clock so I could come back, so I could start working by 10 o'clock in front of the laptop. Obviously, we're doing this. And then I'm going to go and do X, Y, and Z over the rest of the days. But things like you mentioned about learning your Italian, I've got time scheduled in for doing my Duolingo, time for reading, time. You know, I want to try and give myself as much of a routine and agenda every single day. So because I heard a story a long time ago, whenever I told it about growing up, I was in a really troubled area. A lot of people from my area were all going to prison because they've all been involved in things that they felt was important at the time. But two people were going to prison for, say, 20 years. And one of those guys would come out of prison after 20 years and he'd be a fantastic table tennis player because he played table tennis every single day. The other person was come out and he was a scholar, because he's studied his master's, he's done his doctorate, he's done, you know, all these different things. So it's a bit like we all have this situation, we're all on lockdown, and we're all going to come out of this in whether it's 6 weeks, 3 months, or 6 months, or however long. And I'm just wondering what kind of person I'm going to be when I come out of this, because I could be absolutely up to date with every single Netflix series I've ever wanted to watch, or I could come out and I've maybe done my online training course, my e-learning program that I want to create. Maybe I've studied language more. Maybe I've gone back in to learn guitar or piano again. I'm just going to be way more productive than just coming out having done loads of things that probably aren't going to help me long term.
Yeah. I think that's really nice to think that way, that as you said, when we come out of this, it's like, what can you have achieved in this time? And yeah, none of us perhaps would have chosen this or foreseen this, but we certainly, you know, hard work is never wasted. So personally, I'm with you, Paul. I've got a structure, you know, I've got a structure for my son now homeschooling, but also for myself to kind of say, okay, this week I want to achieve this, today I want to do that. And, you know, obviously it's not to say pile on the pressure and kind of, you know, 12 hours a day, but I think it's really, really important to, yeah, have a goal and kind of think, well, if this is what the situation is for however long it's going to be, let's at least do what we can to make the best of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. So I have one closing question for you, but before I ask you that closing question, can you tell the listeners of the show how they can connect with you?
Yeah, the best way for me is all on the socials, everything from Twitter, which is just Paul McVeigh 77, or my Instagram, Paul McVeigh 77, or actually, it's funny, the most business I have and probably the most interaction I have is on LinkedIn. And I'd say I probably get maybe 50 to 60% of my work is on LinkedIn. So anything to do with that would be great. And obviously my website, paulmcveigh.co.uk. But apart from that, just drop us a line, say hello.
Awesome. Thanks, Paul. Okay, so my closing question, which I ask to every guest this year, is if you had an extra hour every single day, so you no longer have 24 hours, you now have 25, because often people say to me, you know, I don't have time, Adrienne, this power hour thing sounds great, but I don't have time. So if I was to give you one extra hour a day, what would you use that extra hour to do?
Okay, so I have a completely different take on this in terms of time, because that excuse of I don't have enough time in the day doesn't wash with me at all. Mm-hmm. Because I have so many people who either say, oh, I can't go to the gym because I'm married with kids, or I can't go to the gym because I've got a full-time job. And then I know other people who are married with kids and full-time job and go to the gym 3 times a week. So that doesn't wash at all with me. So would it be, I don't know if it's a cop-out to say that actually I wouldn't change anything in my life because I...
Use the time you have.
Pretty much, yeah, I use... Put it this way, we have a philosophy and a belief in our Mindspan program. So whenever I do my keynote speaking, and if people like it and they want to do more sort of corporate training, you know, sort of 10 or 15 people in a room for 3 days and we take them through a program, and we have a belief in it that actually time is the greatest resource you'll ever be blessed with. So I see this whole, you know, the Monday morning thing of like getting up on a Monday morning. It's like, oh, Monday, got to go to work. You know, how many people would love to go and do that now? Most people don't even just have that Monday morning feeling on a Monday morning. A lot of get it on a Sunday evening at about 6 or 7 o'clock thinking about the Monday morning.
Yeah.
And for some people, it doesn't even finish at like, you know, 12 or 1 o'clock on a Monday afternoon. Sometimes it can go through to either Thursday evening, or for some people, it's really sad. It goes all the way through to Friday. And I just, something that because of my belief, because of the way that I view time, and because I really do believe it is honestly the most precious resource that I have in my life, and I really do my best to use it wisely for me. Because if we put this into context, have you any idea how many days there are in the average lifetime?
Oh no,
that's a really tough question. But when you ask people massively overestimate how much they think they have, when actually on average in this part of the world we get about 28,000 days.
Okay? Wow.
So we get 28,000 days, right? And I don't know how old you are, Adrian, but you look pretty young, but I'm 42. So I've had about 14,000 days.
Wow. That's,
which
wow,
means
that's...
if I'm lucky, and I've been probably the luckiest kid on the planet for the last 40 years, but if I'm lucky, I will get another 14,000 days if I'm lucky.
Can't waste them. You cannot waste
but
them.
But how many people don't get that? And how many people don't get the average? And we've seen with all the problems that are happening at the minute of people who are getting nowhere near their average. And so see that whole Monday morning feeling, waking up and thinking, oh, it's Monday. I stopped doing that a long, long time ago, because actually, and I'm not some sort of automaton. I don't get up like, you know, like a robot every single day. I'm sure you don't, even though you very quickly get into a mindset that you're going to go running every day. But for me, I don't wake up like this, you know, little positive Duracell battery. But I really understand that even if I'm not in the best frame of mind when I wake up, I need to do something very, very quickly to get myself back into the way that I'm going to go and do something on my Mondays, because I know Mondays don't have the power to make me feel anything, because I'll decide that.
Wow, amazing. That 28,000 days, that is powerful stuff. So I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for being a guest, Paul. And thank you so much to the listeners for tuning in, for giving us your ear, for giving us your time and listening to this show this week. I really, really hope that you are well. I hope that your family members are well. I hope your friends are well. And I really hope that if you enjoyed this episode, that it has, yeah, given you some motivation today and hopefully made you feel good. So if it has, then please do let us know, and please share it with someone else who might value from listening to this episode as well. As always, you can rate and review the show on iTunes. Please do that if you have some extra time right now. If you have a few minutes to spare, then please do rate and review the show. It really helps the show to reach more people and helps me to book new guests. Thanks again. Have a fantastic week. Thanks, Paul.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.